I would love to start with the beginning of your knowledge of being interested in becoming a writer. How do you make sense of your trajectory into becoming the person you are, the career you've had? Was that always of interest to you?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I think that as a biographer, the question that readers have of biography and that the writer has as a biographer is how do we become who we are? Hmm. And I remember once I was in Texas, your home state or your adopted
former
home state,
yeah,
whatever it is. And I was lecturing about talking to school children about some children's books that I had written, and mm-hmm, and talking to them. It was a special program, some school district to expose kids to people from different professions. And one little boy came up to me and he said, "How'd you get to be that thing you are?" And I loved it. It was so, and that's the question. How'd you get to be that thing you are? So, I was a precocious reader, and my mother was an English teacher, English and Latin teacher, and I think she always wanted me to be a writer. I think it was just taken for granted that that's what I would do, by her, by me. So maybe I wasn't destined to be a writer, but somehow that's what it felt like. And I remember in sixth grade having to write, "How do you see yourself in 10 years or something?" And I saw myself exactly as I am now. So I don't know. It just was foreordained in some way. And I was luckily good at it. I'm good at languages. So, it's unfortunate if your ambitions don't coincide with your talents.
True.
And then you have to kind of retool. But for me, it was a sort of natural thing.
Did you always have a sense that you were good at it?
The answer to every question, every single question that anyone can ever ask anyone, is yes and no.
True.
So yes and no. I got very good grades on my, essays, and took the, in the olden days, there was an essay on the SAT, and it was like became, no, the Regents exam. They used it as a model. So I got feedback from the world that my writing was good. Hmm. But in terms of, and I know that when I finish something, it's good. Yes, my work, I've won prizes, I've won this, I've won that. And I know that when I finish something, it's good. But the process of getting from drivel to good,
yeah,
there's not only is there's no confidence there, it's not like, brain surgeon, every day you do another brain operation, you get better at it. It's not like that with writing. Hmm. So you never reach a plateau of confidence, I would say, for me.
Did you launch straight into a writing career immediately after university? What's that story? Did you launch directly into a writing career immediately after university?
Immediately after university, I went to live in Europe, and I was writing poetry. I started out as a poet, and so I was writing poetry and doing the jobs that you do between 20 and 25. I was a barmaid, I was a tutor, I worked for the Poetry Society in London, I was a private chef, did that kind of thing. So I was earning practically no money. I was earning no money. No, let's call it no money from my work until the till the 70s when I came back to New York and started as a journalist.
What was the scene like in New York when you got back here at that time?
The 70s? New York in the 70s. There's a wonderful book by a friend of mine named Guy Trebay, which is a memoir of New York in the 70s. It was dark. It was incredibly exciting. It was dangerous. The arts were absolutely, there was all kinds of experimental theater and music and performance art and little, theaters tucked away in garages and a sense of the world changing. Of course, the 70s was a time of great inflation and time of crime. So it was actually a terrific time to be young and in New York if you didn't get mugged.
What were you doing at that time for work? What was your writing life like?
Well, I came back from Europe and I had to earn a living. Also, the other thing is that rents were unbelievably cheap. You cannot imagine. It's like inconceivable. Hmm. I had an apartment for $75 a month in the West Village next to the police precinct on West 10th Street. Then I had another much nicer apartment in Westbeth, the artist's housing on West Street. That was $140 a month with a view of the river. Hmm. So you could live on very little is what I'm saying. You could live on, you could support yourself as a writer. Tickets anywhere in the world were $200. Hmm. So So I worked, I did book reviews for The Nation, and then Ms. started, the first real modern feminist magazine. And I went to work for them, and that's where I really got my start in journalism.
Mm. How did you end up at The New Yorker? I know you've been there forever, but how do you make sense of that story?
Well, you know, I tell the story in the introduction to Cleopatra's Nose, the first book of my collection of my New Yorker essays. This is not how I ended up there. This has nothing to do with how I ended up there, except for the fact that the family connection to The New Yorker is sort of sweet. My Hungarian grandfather, the grandparents lived in this neighborhood. Hmm. He was a baker, and he was hired by the Fleischmann Yeast Company to run the Viennese Model Bakery on 10th Street and Broadway in the Village. So Ralph Fleischmann was the first publisher. He was the founding publisher of The New Yorker. Hmm. And Ralph Fleischmann, Ralph's father sent Ralph to apprentice. He wanted my grandfather to teach Ralph about the baking business because Ralph was a playboy, you know, rich kid. And so they became friends. My grandfather was considerably older. And Ralph was a sort of patron to the family. He'd take my grandmother in his car and they'd give them opera tickets. And he got my uncle into his college. That didn't go very well. It was a very waspy upper class place. And he gave my mother a job as a receptionist at The New Yorker when she was it was probably the end of the 20s. The magazine was very new. So it was always a revered, not just for me, for every young writer in America. I just happened to have a personal connection. But for every young writer in America, that was the dream place to publish. Hmm. So I finished my first book, which won the National Book Award out of the starting gate. And then I went to, after it was published and it was made into, it was the basis for Out of Africa. So and I was, you know, I was featured in here and there and their various magazines and blah, 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 blah. I just went to Robert Gottlieb, who was then the editor. And we sort of knew, he knew of me, of course, and we probably had some mutual friends. I said, I'd like to write for the magazine. He said, great. That was that. Hmm. It was 1986.
Hmm. Typically at that time, was it the case that writers that would eventually ascend to The New Yorker would have had prior success as you had and then be recruited, or it would just become
it depends. Oh, there were I think by the time Gottlieb took over from William Shawn, there was a staff of very sort of eminent writers, but there were new people. Adam Gopnik was sort of started there about the same time I did, a little before. And I'm not actually sure. I think most of the people were trying to think of new people who came in the initial period that I was there. I'm not sure there were a lot of new people at that stage. Mm. But and I don't know. I don't know. I don't know how people. I think everybody has a different story.
Mm. I mean, I know I speak for millions of people, but as such a longtime fan of the magazine, I would love to learn whatever you're comfortable sharing about what it's like to work there. Do you have full autonomy and freedom to write about whatever you want? What's the process like for people who are staff writers?
Well, you can propose a piece or they propose a piece to you. I think for me, the last, you know, decade, it's mostly been, I've proposed some pieces, but mostly they say, do you want to do this or do you want to do that? And you can say no. Then you go off. Nobody tells you what to say. You go off and you write the piece, but everybody has an editor with whom they work, sort of like a tutor at a British university. You know, that's your editor, and you have a long-standing, quite intimate relationship with that person. Whoever you are, it doesn't matter. They send you back to rewrite the piece, tear it apart, rewrite it over and over and over again. It's very arduous, and people who can't take that kind of heat, can't take that kind of criticism, you know, can't take the process, the collaborative process, won't do well there.
Hmm. The duration of time, I'm sure it changes based upon the piece, but how much time are you generally given to create?
It entirely depends. A profile can take months. You follow somebody for months. A critic's piece, sometimes there's a quick turnaround. I'm really old now, so the anxiety and the deadline stuff, I handle those. I used to write 9-10 pieces a year. I don't know how I did it. I honestly don't know. I think that's all I could do, and I was just like that. So sometimes if there's an opening and you have to get it in the next week's issue, you have to write it really fast. Hmm. But that's usually not such a long piece. Hmm. you know, longer pieces, you can take more time. Sometimes they pieces that involve reporting and travel, they take what they take.
I was reading a profile of you in preparation for meeting you, and one of the comments in this piece about you was that you have always had an interest in writing about women, and especially strong women. And I wanted to give you some space to talk about some of your favorite characters that you've profiled over the years. I mean, my understanding is that amongst the better-known books you've written, Amelia Earhart, Anne Frank, are a couple of other lesser-known characters that you've written about. And I'd love for you to just share, you know, anything that still resonates with you about those women or other women that has stuck with you over the years, and also talk about why it is that strong women have always appealed to you.
Strong women, but also, as I say in that the essay to Cleopatra's Notes, lost women. So women who are, whose reputations have faded, or who are really, really interesting but aren't widely known, or who are in some way, you know, there's a category of transgressive heroines, and then there's a category of as you say, strong women, and wonderful women artists of all kinds. So, you know, there are the living subjects, and then there are the dead subjects, and you have, of course, different relationships with the living subjects, who are subjects of profiles mostly. There are some who are artists whom you don't know. It's a rule that you don't write about a friend. I mean, the incest taboo at the New Yorker is very strong, very, very strong. So I did a profile of Emily Wilson, the first woman to translate the Odyssey, and who's a fascinating character and the daughter of a famous British writer, and a woman of really, really interesting. And we got to go to Ithaca, the, you know, Odysseus's kingdom together, his island together. And that was an amazing trip and experience, and got to know her family. And Yasmina Reza, the same thing, the French writer who was just in New York. Her play Art has just been revived. I got to know her family, and that has been some of these relationships last. Rachel Cusk also. But it's always challenging because you're creating a relationship. Janet Malcolm has written about this. I don't agree with Janet Malcolm's theory or personal experience that you're always betraying your subject. I don't think that's true. I don't think it's necessarily true at all. But you are there to plumb their experience and to sit in judgment in a way, or to in doing a portrait, you're doing their portrait, so you're really, really examining them, and so there are boundaries that you have to be mindful of at sort of pretty much every turn in a story, and that's sort of that's an art in itself. I think, you know, I think it's I wouldn't take on a profile of someone whose work I didn't like, or someone who had the reputation of being absolutely horrible and impossible, of which there are numerous examples. So it's an attraction, and then it's a relationship, however long or brief it is. I had an interesting relationship with the performance artist Vanessa Beecroft. I wound up after the piece was over, and she had liked it, and she wanted me to do. She was going to pay me and to do an interview with her mother for a film that she was making at a fasting spa in the desert in California. And so I went out there. There was a film crew that was just blah, 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 blah. And I wound up being so fascinated by the fasting spa that I asked the New Yorker, I said, I want to write about the fasting spa. And then I had to, of course, pay my own expenses, pay Vanessa back for all the own expenses. She was delighted about that too. So those are the personal with the living subjects, and with the dead subjects. For example, I just finished this piece on Gertrude Stein. I had to find a way to be fair to Gertrude Stein, really thinking that she's kind of an unbelievably overrated cult-like, guru-like figure. So to be a critic is to be very judgmental, right? But so you're always chastening you're always trying to see things yes and no, you know, seeing things with the third eye. And so it was a struggle to write fairly about Gertrude Stein. And there is a certain antagonistic quality that I think the piece has. It was based, I was reviewing a very good biography. It wasn't that the book itself was not, the book is very worthy. So that sometimes happens. And sometimes you make a mistake. Years later, it proves that you've been wrong about something. Early on in the 80s, I reviewed The Handmaid's Tale, the Margaret Atwood thing. And at the time, you can't see the future. It proved to be prophetic. But at the time, I thought she's not being honest about this, the kind of sensationalistic sexual aspect of this book. So it's interesting to look back on a career as long as I've had at The New Yorker and see what works and doesn't with the benefit of hindsight.
The Stein piece, which I just got done with yesterday, I think you used the word cult in one of the last few sentences of the piece.
Right, her cult lives on, yeah.
What is it about Gertrude Stein that has allowed the cult of her to persist all these years after her death? Why is it that, given that you make the argument that she is overrated, that she's still such
Nobody reads Gertrude Stein, except it. No. First of all, what's enabled it to live on is that nobody reads. No, you can't. No one reads it. So that's not true. Academics and people and Stein, scholars, graduate students, they maybe some feminist studies departments, I don't know about that. But she created a cult of personality from the get-go. She, you know, as I write in the piece, she thought that she was as great a writer as Homer, Shakespeare, and the Bible. And then she had this very interesting salon and friendships. And I thought yesterday, walking home from dinner with friends, writers, the autobiography of Alice B. Toklas, which is her most famous book, which is widely read, and what that really is. It's like those writers' houses, the House of Proust or the Soane's Museum in London or Charleston, the Bloomsbury thing. It's that book is the word equivalent of a literary tourist attraction. And I think she intended it that way. She wrote it for money. She needed money. She was very upset that a book she considered not her serious work should be lauded and taken seriously and become such a bestseller. She loved the fame. She loved the attention. But she, you know, that wasn't what she felt that her art was about. So the fact she made her salon, her life, and her circle of friends into a literary tourist attraction. And the kind of people who go on the book tours that visit all the writers' houses are the kind of people who have always considered Stein, on her own say-so, a genius.
Fascinating. And the people that attended the salon are some of the most famous artists of the 20th century.
Right. They weren't at the time, but they became that. Yes.
This is top of mind because I just got back from Amsterdam a few weeks ago, and my understanding is that you did spend some time profiling or writing about Anne Frank.
Yeah, that was a book. I went to Amsterdam much later, and it was, by the time I got there, you had to buy tickets to the Anne Frank house. There was a line around the block. It was in the early, had I gone in the 80s when I wrote the piece, it would have been a different experience. Yeah, I was a very close friend of Philip Roth's. And he helped me with that piece. His greatest book, in my view, is The Ghostwriter, which is a story of a young writer who goes to visit an old writer, and there's this mysterious young woman who's sort of acolyte, and the fantasy of the young writer is that this is Anne Frank. So, of course, I read The Diary of Anne Frank that independently of when I was a young girl myself, and it's an extraordinary book. It's a really seriously great work of literature. So it exists. The fact that this was a young woman murdered by the Nazis, and the fact that she wrote this extraordinary book, and that the book was somehow found and preserved. So it was a dramatic story. But the occasion for the review was the Dutch commission on whatever it was published an annotated edition in which every fact, every name, every line was like 1,000 pages. The diary itself is, 200 pages. So this was a monumental intellectual edifice, and that was the occasion for the review.
What has stayed with you about her as an example, as a person, as a writer?
The freedom, her freedom to feel. I think one of the great issues for pretty much all the women writers and artists that I have read about and talked about now teaching freedom of desire. And I think Anne Frank had an exceptional, she had access to the truth of her feelings, the freedom of her feelings. She could speak. The diary has, it's not the sort of stilted, good girl voice of a, I mean, it's not a sort of wild transgressive writing. She's exploring who she is. Mm. We're talking about how do you become who you are. She was precociously aware of who she was. Mm. And to be precociously aware of who you are, you have to know what your urges are. You have to know what your wants are. You have to know what your attractions are. You have to know what repulses you. And she was precociously aware of those things.
Hmm. Amazing, given that she was 13 or 14 years.
Yeah, and in hiding in a prisoner of in a garage somewhere in Amsterdam.
I think you said earlier in the conversation that in addition to strong women, you've also written about lost women. I don't know if she fits into this category, but the story of Amelia Earhart, which I think you also spent some time profiling her, writing about.
Yeah, Amelia Earhart. There's a new book, which I haven't read yet, but it's about how Amelia Earhart was also a kind of publicity. Amelia Earhart was a brave and interesting young woman, kind of fearless, Amelia Earhart, there was so much of a image making in Amelia Earhart's life. Her husband George Putnam, who really sort of arranged all of he made Amelia Earhart. There were so many women aviators in her generation who were so much better flyers. They were so much, but she wasn't a terribly good pilot, and she took crazy risks partly for the story. And she was the Putnam, she wrote books and this and that and appearances. And she was very beautiful. And she was a patrician. So she fit, she fit the slots of a public's appetite for a certain kind of female hero. Of course, her exploits as a flyer are very interesting. But again, there were many flyers who were both better aviators and did just feats just as impressive, but who weren't Amelia Earhart. And of course, her death. The thing is, dying young, Deanne Arbus, Sylvia Plath, Amelia Earhart, Anne Sexton, all kinds of glamorous women who die young either by accident or because they kill themselves. That preserves you at the height of your powers. Hmm. And you pass into legend at the height of your powers, not as a forgotten old person. Hmm. And I think that's absolutely part of it. The whole country was fixated on finding her, including the president. Hmm.
When you look back on your career, and I think, but maybe before we were recording, I think you were mentioning you're working on an autobiography or a history of your...
No, it's not an autobiography. I don't want to talk about it because it's too unformed.
Too early. Do you have favorite characters that you think back on, both as people that you admire or that have just penetrated you more? You've written about a lot of people in your career.
Yeah.
Are there one or two or, I don't know, a list in your head of your personal favorites in some way?
I don't know what you mean. It's too much. The question's too broad. If you can just like narrow it down a little bit.
How about this way? A character or an individual that you've profiled whose example has most affected you?
Oh, people who are profiled who's most affected me. I don't know. Affected me. Well, both subjects of my biographies, Colette and Isaac Dinesen, affected me deeply because I spent 7 years with one and 8 years with another.
Yeah.
So that's like a marriage. I don't think I've been affected as profoundly by the subjects of my... They're part of my life. I have experiences that I treasure and experiences that I recall from every New Yorker profile, but it's not the same as a book.
I would love to learn about the decision, as you said, these amount of time you've spent with the subjects that you've actually written books about is akin to a marriage. How have you known in your career when you have stumbled upon a subject that is worthy?
You don't know. No idea. I've often described it in lectures as, you know, in certain cultures, a parent or a clan or whatever arranges, because you have to have exogamy. Otherwise, you know, a small community will die out or be affected by birth defects. You have to marry the girls out, and you have to bring brides in from outside. So in those cultures like that, the bride will be sent with on her mule or her horse or with her, you know, in however, to cross the mountain to another, to marry a groom she's never seen. And while it's a slight exaggeration, it's like that with biography. You set out as the Himalayan bride into the dark of the archives, not knowing who you're going to find. You think you know. You've been told certain things about the subject. You've learned certain things about the subject, but you really don't know what you're going to find. And there's no turning back.
I'd love to talk about Isaac a little bit. How did that story come to you? How did you begin to want to focus on it?
Gloria Steinem loved Isaac Dinesen. And so she asked me to write about her for Ms. And at the time, she was one of those lost women. She had been extremely popular in America in the 50s and 60s and 40s, 50s, 60s. But by the 70s, no one remembered her really. And people asked me all the time, Isaac Dinesen, who's he? And so I wrote a very interesting article on her for Ms. And it was, I made it up. I didn't make up the facts, but I made up a character. It was an invented interview with an old Danish noblewoman who had supposedly been close to her, and it just came to me the way no other piece ever has. And the character was based on a composite character of several old European worldly wonderful women whom I'd known, including the mother of a friend who'd given me my first Dinesen book, and it was so lifelike that Dinesen's secretary wrote to me through the magazine wanting to know who that woman had been, because she needed to correct certain of the things that she had said. And then I'm reading it, you know, rereading it, I'm amazed that it was, as I said somewhere, I heard my voice as a mature writer coming to me from the future in the voice of that character. And a young editor named Michael Denny, pioneering editor of, he was a pioneer of gay literature in the 70s. He loved Dinesen. He'd studied it with Hannah Arendt at the University of Chicago. Arendt loved Dinesen. And he said, and he called me, he said, I want you to do a biography. I said, don't be silly. That's ridiculous. I've never written any more than 10 pages. We really hit it off. We liked each other, and he tried to convince me, I just said no. And then he said, "Okay, really." And he did. I was really on the fence, although we would have these three martini dinners and in those days, in smoky restaurants. Finally, he said, "Well, what would you? Let's just say you agreed to do it. What kind of advance would you need?" And I thought, well, this is my opportunity to get out of this damn thing. So I named the largest sum of money I could think of. I said, I would need $10,000. He said, done. That was that. That was the bride price.
What has stayed with you about her?
What?
What has stayed with you about her?
Pretty much everything.
When people ask you about her, which I'm sure they still do,
they don't.
What stories still stick with you about her life, her example?
No, I can't. That's a question that is too boring to answer. I mean, not that your question is boring. It's that I'll say this. What's interesting to me now, there's nothing about her life that I don't know.
Yeah.
There's no aspect of it that I haven't thought about. I have deep roots in Denmark. My closest friend, beloved friend of mine, who's I met almost 50 years ago, who's still my closest. So I have a deep connection with the whole world of Dinesen, the Danish world. recently, I got an email out of the blue from a Kenyan woman, young Kenyan woman, who is in fact Kikuyu. And she was fascinated by Dennis and wanted to meet me and to talk about it because she was torn. Kenyan writers, male writers, have, for reasons which I completely understand, torn into Dennison for her colonialist and her racist and colonialist, for the sort of both coded and not coded and explicit colonialism out of Africa. Hmm. So she was trying to come to terms with her, both her interest in Dennison and the fact that her grandmother could have been one of those people on Dennison's farm whose land had been expropriated by the British and the other white settlers.
Yeah.
So I've been having a very interesting conversation with her about that aspect of Dennison's work, which I did not consider enough. Hmm. And when I wrote a new introduction to the biography, which came out again recently, I sort of wrote a mea culpa that I had not sufficiently considered the colonial aspect. I consider them somewhat. It's not completely absent, but I did not consider it sufficiently at all. Hmm. So that, I would say, is what, at the moment, that's what I keep coming back to and wishing I could have done differently.
Yeah. I'd love to hear, for any writers out there who hear this, about your writing habits or process. I don't know if you have a rigidity to when during the day you right when you work. I'd love to hear about how you have thought about that, how you've lived that.
It changes throughout your lifetime. It changes depending on your circumstances. When I had a kid, I had, when he was a child, I had a nanny, I had a babysitter for 5 hours a day, and that was when I wrote, 12 to 5. That was it. There was no other time. In the early days of when I was living alone, before I was married or had a partner, whatever, I loved working at night. I would work all night because I had an office. At the time I had a small studio apartment, but I had a very nice office not far away. And I liked the separation of home and you don't soil your own nest. You go somewhere else to soil it. I liked that separation very much. And I loved working at night because the hum of the world is quiet, and you're also not in people's thoughts at night. And I do believe we pick up all kinds of vibes or of energy from the atmosphere. So I like working at night. Now I like getting up early and starting work with the fresh light of morning because I have an elderly brain, and to the degree that it's still pretty active and with it, morning. 9 to 1, 9 to 2, take a break, go for a walk, come back. And then you can fiddle still, but you're probably not going to get a lot of, you're not going to break a lot of new ground at that time.
Hmm. At this point in your life, when you're writing between those hours of 9 and noon or 9 and 9 to 1, are you sufficiently caffeinated by the time you begin to do your actual work? Do you go on a walk?
Depends how much anxiety you have. Caffeine can only do so much.
So back in the day when you were working late at night, was that the only time you would actually be at it in an intensive way, was a nocturnal existence?
Well, I remember finishing the Dennison book. A friend lent me a cottage in, what was it called? Point Lookout, which is it's Rockaway Beach is here, and Point Lookout is the far end of that strip of Long Island. And I was out there. I was married at the time, my first husband. I would go out on Monday morning and come back on Friday night, and so I was alone for the whole week. Hmm. And I would get up at about noon, 1 o'clock, go for a run. Start working at about 3 and go to bed at about 4 in the morning.
Wow.
That was, it was to heaven. I loved it. There was no computer. I mean, I had a typewriter. There was no cell phone. There was, you didn't have screens. You just had your work and your meals and going, buying whatever you needed in the local store and writing. That was about the happiest experience I've ever had writing.
I want to talk about that because that sounds like a very monkish existence.
Yeah, it was.
And what do you attribute that level of, because I think for a lot of people, they would hear that level of isolation and think that sounds like hell.
Well, they shouldn't do that job. Definitely not.
What do you think contributed to that level of well-being to look back?
Getting somewhere. I was finally, this was towards the end. I was working in a white heat that only comes at a certain point when you've excavated, when you have a first draft and you're out of the mire. It's also what stage you are in the composition that was also so heavy because I knew I was getting there.
Hmm. There was a momentum to that
tremendous sense of
you put in the work prior and now you were getting some juice, getting some movement.
Definitely.
I'd love to ask you this for people that might come across this who see your career and would love to emulate you, would love to have a career like you. What kind of qualities? We talked about your youth a little bit.
No, you don't become a writer because you want a career.
Hmm.
You just do not. That's a very bad idea. I mean, yes, if you want to write detective novels or you want to write romance or thrillers, or if you're a genre writer and there's a program, there's an algorithm, you read a million things and you see how you're... If you want to become a literary writer, you really have to just love language and reading and never expect to make money.
Hmm.
So if that's appealing to people, love language, get inside read the writers who love language, read the great writers whose sentences are don't die.
Hmm.
And then and see if you have it in you. You may not have it in you.
Hmm.
But don't. It's not a career. It's a bad, especially the in this in 2025. It's really not a good idea. So you have to want it. Let me put it this way: you have to do it. You have to.
Almost like you couldn't not do it.
Yeah, I would discourage anybody who couldn't not do it from wanting to do it.
Hmm. Do you find that to be a common theme among your contemporaries that? Writers who you know, who you're friends with, who do what you do, also have a similar story. They couldn't not do what they do.
Most people wanted to be writers, but then you know it's sort of like a lot of people want to be Navy SEALs. So there's a triage, and it's brutal. So the people I know, on the whole, are people. Some of them, not all of them. I know some young writers too. They're just determined. They're just really determined. And that determination. And here's something else that's very important. Humility. Philip Roth, who, as I say, was a very close friend, he suffered terribly to write. He hated every sentence. He was a monk, well, in some respects. He would give his work to close group of friends of four or five people he really trusted, and then he would sit with a tape recorder and you would tell him what you thought was wrong with it. He wanted to hear what was wrong with it. He tore it apart. Revision, being incredibly self-critical, is probably the single most important thing. People who are complacent, who don't want to work, who've done enough, it's never going to be good enough. It's just never. There are people who have a tremendous facility. I take that back because there are people who just, I don't know, Anne Frank, I think she probably had that. But what would have happened had she survived and tried to write fiction or tried to write plays, I don't know. But there, some people just, I have colleagues at The New Yorker who can write a 5,000 word piece in a weekend, which is, you kind of have to hate them, but you know, no. So, but there is such a thing as that kind of facility. And they're very good writers. I'm not saying that they're not. But for usually for fiction, for you don't sit down. Yes, Stendhal wrote The Charterhouse Apartment in 6 weeks, but that was him. Mm-hmm. You know, I think for most mortals, people who are not geniuses, people who are very good writers but aren't geniuses, revision, and more revision, and humility, and self-flagellation. get at the scourge, sharpen it up. Yeah.
You talked a minute ago about needing a love for language. And I'm curious, when you were young, or even now, who are the writers you look to that inspired you, that gave you that sense that there's an enduring quality to their work?
Chekhov, Flaubert, Emily Dickinson, Emily Brontë, George Eliot, a bunch of modern poets, Elizabeth Bishop. I don't know. I could just sort of look at the bookshelves and certain biographers, Richard Ellman, Graham Robb. Prison Footsteps. His name will come to me. Proust's Almost Above All. Kafka. It's almost too many to name.
Is it rooted in an appreciation of the beauty of how they use language?
Yeah.
Or the insight?
Both. I mean, the beauty is the insight.
Good point.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know
it's also the precision. I mean, because beauty is also precision. Insight is precision. Character is precision. And it's also the ability to contain the contradictions that the yes-no thing. Without any fake resolutions, without trying to reassure people that things can be resolved.
I know we're getting a little short on time. One of the things I knew I wanted to talk to you about was the role of the journalist and the writer now in contemporary times. I don't know how deeply you think about that.
We all think about it because, first of all, the AI revolution, how is this going to affect writing? A young friend of mine was saying he was a documentary filmmaker. Now he's making documentaries with AI. Like, I had a BlackBerry until they stopped supporting it. So I'm like the last person to understand any sort of technology. And of course, media is shrinking, and the news and social media and all kinds of apps are taking over the sphere that used to be about long-form journalism. So I don't know. I think the future it has never seemed more opaque. It's never seemed more frightening. It's never seemed more unsure. As a person my age, it's never seen more mine. So I sort of look at this new world at a distance, and I say to myself, I'm glad I'm not going to have to deal with it too much longer, honestly. And at the same time, I'm very curious. If I could stick around without having to be part of it to see what happens, I would love to do that.
In its best sense, even today, given the uncertainty of the future, how do you view the role of the journalist in society?
Telling the journalist, this is a society, we are in a truth famine. This is a truth famine. We are the journalists bring water from the desert in tankers, and dig them out of the sandstorms. I think we are assaulted in every form, in every way, by the most pernicious, sloppy, manipulative language. Ads, political speak, political ads, political, the blather, the lies. It's a sort of journalism seems to me a safeguard, a guardrail of there's no such thing as truth, but truth within quotation marks, but something that's not a drivel, and something that's not lies, and something that's not misleading, and something that's not manipulative. And ideally, journalism demanipulates the information that people are getting elsewhere.
Maybe we can close with this, because I would imagine listeners would be interested to get your ideas and suggestions. Who are living journalists that are writing now, who you admire, respect, would refer friends to for the non-drivel, the non-manipulation?
Well, I think I'm very proud to be a New Yorker writer, because I think my colleagues at the magazine are in that camp, all of them. And I think the editor, David Remnick, holds us all to that standard of factuality and of clarity of expression and clarity of thought. The Atlantic, the writers at the Atlantic, same thing. There are lots of... And then there's some very interesting people on Substack, but they're clear about that this is opinion. It's not, you know, these are people voicing their opinions. I don't want to single out people by name because I wouldn't then be singling out other people by name. And the minute you left, I would think, oh my God, why didn't I mention that person? It's like the acknowledgements to a book. You don't want to.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Judith, thank you so much for doing this.
A pleasure.